Mr. Gallagher was as well, and I said this before they got serious somewhere. Commissioners, which did in Farmers Lake, and it was one of the rural living group, and then it now becomes a station limit, which is understood in Skewery subzone. Paragraph 1, which recalled that presentation yesterday are adopted in relation to planning deliveries in both of the grounds today. Here's the evidence of Farmers Lake Limited, one of the group. He will propose amendments which are similar in content, although different in detail, to a equivalent amendment proposed on Mr. Farrell yesterday. Effectively, two panels agreed to come up with slightly different recommendations. That gives the panel different options to consider to achieve similar outcomes. I note that since preparing a body of evidence, Mr. Bowen has given further consideration to recommend amendments in Chapter 21, Objective Policies and Assessment Matters, related to Watchful Basin. On reflection, he did not consider that the proposed limits quite captured what he intended, and in the summary today he will propose a slightly amended wording of one policy, plus one additional proposed ALC assessment matter for you to consider. So just interpolated paragraph 3 there, something you may wish to note, Mr. Chairman, in relation to the timing of later hearings. That was a little phrase called OIC only in Queensland. You may not be aware that the council yesterday resolved to effectively organise Lane Smile.
So I am aware of that. And as I can report from the discussion that we had when we were making submissions yesterday regarding the idea of some structured heavy process for the Walkerston Basin, that I've raised that with Mr. Avery and we're meeting with him. Just before
the
deliberations, discuss that in more detail.
Yeah. So. Well, the point I was going to make, sir, was that it's a time issue. That proposal approved by Council yesterday, recommendation from the Minister as an SHO, well, I assume be accepted by the Minister. Very likely.
He's an engineer.
He's an engineer.
Yeah, he knows. Zero or one.
Seems very likely. Due to the SHA legislation expiring on the 16th of September, they will have to appear a voluntary consent application for that development by that date. That means a likely consent decision by my estimation in this year or first of next year. And if consent is highly likely to implement, and that will likely happen, looking at the current timetable, I think it's probably for these own years. So I'm just alerting you to the fact that there was a major council initiative, which if it comes out as council proposes, fundamentally change the sort of environment and baseline considerations in the Ladies' Mile, and that will impact on, or very likely impact on, a number of other solutions in the Ladies' Mile. Mm-hmm. So, you know, think about that in terms of timing. Well, if you start hearing voting here in the next meeting next year, you're not going to push back involved with that speaking.
Well, I think, in fear, that makes some form of realistic planning and facing more desirable,
even
rather
more
than less desirable.
We couldn't do this way. I'll move on. Skewery subzones. Now, I'm just repeating here the concerns I expressed yesterday about hearing process. I won't repeat that. I note that Mount Corona Station on the Grove is all of the land contained within the Mount Corona Station Special Zone, located at the Grove Valley at the foot of Mount Corona, beside the entrance to the State Highway, off the State Highway to the ski field, the Grove Ski Field Access Road. Now, the MCSS here is not included in Stage 1. The Mount Corona Commission relates entirely to future gondola access from the MCSS here up to the Grove Ski Field. That submission addresses the following issues. Considering a gondola within a ski area, some zone raises some debatable interpretation issues around whether a gondola falls within the definition of a ski area activity. The MCSS specifically contemplates gondola access from the MCSS up to the Donor Ski Field, and in fact, it is provided for in that zone as a discretionary activity. But there was a physical gap between the lower MCSS and the higher the Donor Ski Area subzone, which is zone rural, and where a gondola is an uncompliant activity. And as a result of the above accommodation provisions, consenting a gondola intended to extend from the MCS to set up to the Donor Ski Field raises complex and unnecessary consent rules. And for the benefit of those persons who may not be aware of it, the outcome was involved in consenting a triple cone gondola, not yet built, and the slope farm gondola, not yet built. And they were both lengthy, complex, and extensive consent processes due to the combination of these legal issues that I've referred to here, plus a pretty ideological opponent and other people by Mental Society, plus the fact that in reality the ONL provisions simply don't anticipate structures that go from Valley for the mountain top. So they were both very difficult consensus. And ironically, in fact, I'll go to paragraph 6. The Mount Corona solution seeks to resolve these issues by clarifying definitions relating to gondola and by extending the Corona ski area subzone by a link down to the MCSZ. Or by way of alternative relief, if the link is not approved, the Mount Corona solution seeks amended provisions to apply to any part of the gondola located in the rural zone between the MCSZ and the Corona ski area subzone. And I continue to the last page, and this is just a 2 minute summary of what you'll hear about in the rezoning hearing. You'll see the Cadrona Ski Area subzone. This is one page of the Mount Cadrona Ski Field Ski Mount Station of the submission. You'll see the Cadrona Ski Area subzone, large dotted yellow, and inside the box 24A, which is a different size family map, you'll see the yellow MCSZ, and between the two, there's a little gap. Now, the proposed gondola has been planned. Geotechnical work's been done, the route's been located, the parking place has been located, and you'll hear all about that. It's about 5 kilometres long, and 4.5 kilometres are either in the ski area subzone or the MCSZ, and there's a half kilometre gap between the two, which changes the consent status of the whole thing. And secondly, and also potentially relevantly to the length issue, is that what I would call the primary gondola from the main base station up to the ski field is entirely inside the ski area subzone, because that ski area subzone is actually comes a long way down the side of Mount Cadrona. And what Mount Cadrona Station is interested in is a proposed secondary link, which will get people from the village up to the primary gondola base station. So what can't make more than
that? I can't understand why the focus is on the zoning rather than the rule.
Well,
I would have thought that the approach of you have a ski field, you have a valley floor, a rule that may provision for a transport connection between the two that isn't proposed as something other than non-compliant, but instead of appropriate criteria would be the sensible way to go, given that all the ski fields in the lifter have the same mission.
I agree, sir, and I think all the submissions, and there are a number of submissions on this issue.
But in the end, the proposal wants to rezone the land. You can put a gondola up at this structure. It's rather futile, given that the gondola is in
And in the deer, it's not on the leg.
Well, the
pylons are actually. Well, the pylons are, the pins on the vehicles are produced, some of the ones produced, the pylons are only every half a kilometre.
Right. Yes.
Or even a kilometre. But they're not, it's not a, it's like, not like a series of telephone poles.
I'm not so agree with what you say, sir, which is why the Mount of submission seeks alternative relief. So either rezone or change the rules.
Mm.
Basically, so. When we come back to a rezone hearing, we'll revisit with that.
And likewise, it's a bit practical.
Point made, Mr. Brown, of course, we'll be here.
I'm encouraging Mr. Brown to hear that.
So I think that paragraph 7, in order to achieve the outcomes requested in the Mount submission, obviously, business was entered between 1, between 2 and next year. Three separate hearings, one case, and out of the page. Therefore, all the evidence is relevant. That's what we talked about yesterday. And I did record in paragraph 9 that the panel issued an invitation for things to be heard together at once, and we did actually ask for that, some girls, but it didn't seem to happen, so I'm not sure what happened there.
So really, I think we did have a request from someone that will skip the
series
we did together, and I think that was highly likely.
I think when we wrote that, we kind of thought the whole cases would be heard together rather than just the rezoning bit, so anyway, we'll get there. Schedule 11, Mr. Brown's evidence, was recorded a number of issues that have been accepted by council staff, and I acknowledge council staff have come a long way towards addressing issues raised in the submission. There was a few minor outstanding issues which Mr. Brown addresses. One relates to the definition of passenger lift systems. Any such development through the ancillary buildings, embarkation, ticket office, is usually a toilet. And there may be debate about whether ancillary buildings are part of a passenger lift system, and we're just proposing that to avoid any debate about that, they should specifically be referenced in one of the definitions. The second point is that the 22A report proposes to exempt passenger lift systems from some standards and rules only, but not from others. We submit that the exemption from the standards and covering three needs to be complete, otherwise it's pointless, particularly in relation to height, because it's unlikely that you've got the proposal to comply with the standard rule zone 8 meter height limit. And there's no downside to the exemption from the convention in Table 3 because there was a separate Table 7 which specifically addressed passenger lift systems. And thirdly, the 44 report correctly proposes a separate activity category for passenger lift systems located outside the ski area subzone, but I missed actually provide for the default consent status. And it's just an oversight. Mr. Brown recommends the appropriate consent status is restricted discretionary on the basis that the consent pass should be relatively easy. But the council should have power to refuse consent to a passenger lift system which is located in a particularly inappropriate location. That's my solution, sir. Unless you have any questions, I'll leave Mr. Brown to present this case.
Any quick questions?
I'll just head it up in my submission. We have a series of 2.5-page summary statements which the witnesses read as we come to the witnesses, which I'll hand up at that time. So paragraph 1.1, I'm here today on behalf of Queenstown Park and the Queenstown Wharves. The Wharves issue relates to the surface of water, so I just refer to specifically as Queenstown Park to refer to these submissions. To try and bring our case together, QPL case faithfulness evidence can be summarised as follows. Tourism and recreation activities are better than farming activities an ecological perspective, and Mr. Beale will speak to that in evidence. Farming may contribute to landscape values and rural character, but that contribution is not limited to partial grazing or openness. It can include, for example, shelter ups and vines. So we have landscape evidence, we heard from Ms. Fluger and Ms. Baxter about this character in the basin and rural zones. The landscape values and rural character of the district are widely variable, and in some locations farming makes no contribution to landscape values and rural character. Farming makes an insignificant direct contribution to the district's economic well-being, and its indirect contribution as an activity that maintains the rural character is not as significant as the council claims, and that carries on for reasons I've set out above. Tourism and recreation activities make a significant contribution to the district's economic and social well-being, and the agglomeration and expansion of tourism activities is important to ensuring that contribution continues into the future. And you'll hear from Professors Milne and Hazeldine on that topic in terms of tourism in this district and its future and the need to widen the tourism offering, or as Professor Milne described it, deepening the tourism offering. And you would have seen that in your evidence.
Is there a suggestion that's going to stop next year?
No, but we want to press forward positively, I think is what we're suggesting here, and there's a need to do that. And given the above, the proposed district plan should provide for tourism and commercial activities in positive terms. And that's really where the rubber hits the road in terms of Mr. Brown means. We want to talk positively about these activities, not negatively, whilst also addressing potential adverse environmental effects. And QPL considers it did provide provisions to achieve this. As a preliminary observation, it appears to me, and I might be optimistic, that the Council and QPR are not that far apart in terms of intended resource management outcomes. In fact, the opening submissions of Council to the Council confirmed that the Council agrees that non-farming activities should be able to establish in the rural zone. That's also what we're striving to achieve. However, Council to the Council firstly, it's critical of the incorrect factual premise underlying the QPL, and in particular its witness, Professor Hazeldine, and asserts that QPL's case has been advanced in somewhat of a vacuum because its witness, or witnesses, have not considered the Council's highly strategic approach. Now, we sort of, well, I can be not clear about this, but correct, but I think the Council and QPL have been talking across each other a bit here. We see its clear and strategic directions factor. The first goal is the resilient, prosperous economy. There's clear economic drivers for this district. We go down into the landscape zone, there's an acknowledgement of tourism, and we come to the rural chapters, and there's an acknowledgement of tourism in the rural zone. So we're all on the same page. What we say is when you read the scheme of those policies, those tourism or commercial activities are framed in negative terms, and there's an assumption of a grade character. We think that you've got the assessment criteria right, and you've got the characteristics or character, rural character, you can be very safe in that quality. You can be positive about tourism and commercial activities in rural areas, and if that's important for the council officer who's receiving applications to understand that there is an expectation that these activities will occur, not that you need to prevent them unless there's a sort of exceptional, there's a rare case of establishing rural zones. So it's just the balance and flavour of those policies that causes us concern.
You think the issue may have arisen because the option of district plan is written in negative?
Yeah.
And there's been a bit of translation problem, if you like, to try and attempt to write a positive plan.
Well, there have been a number of factors like that, and I'm constantly told to make a positive statement rather than a negative statement, because it's clearer if you can. But yes, that might be an issue. Aligned to the way the policies are framed, another issue is the default activity status. Previously, if an activity wasn't specifically identified in the rural zone, it defaulted to permitted, and you had to meet the various assessment criteria. So you had
But that was a false. If you read the plan in its whole, that was a false. Plans are permitted because there was virtually nothing permitted.
Well,
there was always hidden in there somewhere a rule that made it non-compliant or discretionary.
But I think, yeah, if you triggered one understanding that you failed on one of these kind of criteria, you went to restrict the screening. But if there was a door in, the door might slam pretty quickly when you look at the blueprint and so on. But at least then, that rule gave the impression that if you meet the effects assessment, or you meet the assessment matters, we'll have a look at the application, not the non-compliant status. Mm. What we've listed is this. So it had a different flavour again. If you can bring the applications to us to deal with the test, the risk assessment standards, and the plan expects that. So that change, that I take your point, that it probably was a back door, but that change is quite significant in terms of the flow from the scheme of the rules, I think, quite prescriptive now. And that's the fear to QPL, that a planner will take that approach. I think it's quite narrow, it's quite prescriptive. The objectives and policies clearly emphasise farming. The commercial activity policy, for instance, says as long as you don't contingent on farming, so it says that constant flavour, which we think is too negative. I'll pretty much summarise my submission now, too, so I'll carry on 1.6. So, in terms of this underlying incorrect factual premise, that premise is that we say it's either discouraging or not encouraging of commercial activity. The council disagrees with that, but that's how we read the flow of the plan. So 1.5, QPL does not accept that its evidence is based on an incorrect factual premise. It considers that the rural objectives and policies do not encourage non-farming activities, either directly, with expressed words, or by reasonable inference in terms of the scheme of that chapter. And the evidence for the council is unfavourable in relation to non-farming activities, in particular Mr. Osborne and Dr. Reed. QPL also considers that its provisions better align with the strategic directions chapter than the council because they expressly provide for development of a prosperous, resilient and equitable economy. Now that's goal one, the strategic directions chapter, that's significant, so that's in the front of our mind, and also the diversification of rural land use. In my submission, picking up on council officer issue, an important question for the panel is whether there is a risk that a council officer will interpret the council's version as expressing a tepid or even negative attitude towards tourism and commercial activities in the rural zone. QPL considers the answer to that question is yes, and that this impression will discourage potential applicants, significantly increase consenting costs, and increase the prospect of consent applications being declined. In short, the implication is that diversification and economic growth will be inhibited. QPL's case focuses on economic well-being under Section 5.2. We also, listening to Commissioner Lawson yesterday discussing social well-being, it's been a discussion we've had as a group overnight and yesterday afternoon, and the witnesses will discuss the benefits of social well-being and recreation in terms of an active lifestyle, integrating with the community, getting out and going to places and experiencing and meeting the people you live with. So there's a social well-being aspect to recreation generally, and also the growth in tourism opportunities may free up some of the natural resources in the district for locals who may not otherwise use the gondola because it's packed with tourists, or may not access some of the mountain rock trails because they are packed with tourists. So there's certainly a social well-being aspect to recreation and commercial recreation, and Mr. Green will have to speak to that, and Professor Milne. So we can pick up on that. So those are the two well-beings under Section 5.2, and of course, you have focused on the economic well-being. And also, the opportunity for economic growth under Section 32. The evidence also addresses Section 6 B and C, from 7 B and D and E. And we're certainly not denying that effects on rural character and community are important, very important, and on that fact mention. But interestingly, in that case, we only deduce minor amendments to the rules. The rules are very much as they are proposed by the council, getting the policy framework a bit more positive, so that those rules bring light into an opportunity that people expect to be there. At section 2, just talking through the revisions, I set out Mr. Brown's evidence, and as a general statement, the QPL's revisions are based on a preference for the rural zone planning regime found in the ODP over the council's proposed regimes. In particular, the change in the bulk activity status from committed non-compliant activities, we've discussed that too, but I don't think I need to blunt the rule over that again. But Mr. Brown has described that shift in the board regulation on that regulate enable continuum, so that's a concern to him it's the kind of flavour of the overall chapter through those amendments. So 2.3, Mr. Brown recommends that there be a positively framed set of objectives and policies for non-farming activities. It is submitted to council objectives and policies cast non-farming activities in a negative light because non-farming objectives and policies appear toward the end of a full suite of objectives and policies. That's 21.2.9 and 21.10. Further and aligned to A above, the non-farming objectives and policies are preceded by many provisions promoting farm use in the rural zone. And 21.2.9 is framed negatively due to the focus on the verb degrade. This language is quite different to, for example, that which applies to farming in objective 21.2.1. So that's probably quite a simple way to look at it. The way non-farming activities are framed in an objective or policy, we've got to see that same sort of language that commercial activities are enabled, provided that that's how farming pitched in this zone. We see no reason, based on our experts analysis of effects, that commercial activities can't be framed that way as well. The evidence for QPL discloses that commercial uses can have similar or lesser environmental effects than farming. Than farming activity. Therefore, as I've just mentioned, there is no reason why an objective reducing commercial activities cannot be positively framed. And to that end, Mr. Brown's provisions promote non-farming objectives and policies up the back of order, as he describes it, and frame the key objective, which is 21.2.2, in his evidence in positive language. And that's what he describes as a reconstitution and amalgamation, I think, of 21.2.9 and 21.2.10. It is admitted that Mr. Brown's objectives and policies give effect to the Council's strategic direction and have stated and intended communicated by Council to Council that farming activities, that non-farming activities can establish in the rural zone, and is also consistent with the generally positive language in 638.
I'll just go to that concern, because I rely on the notified version. And this is objective in the rural design, here in the landscape side, which I think is important. Recognise the dependence of tourism on the district's landscapes. Now, you can read that in the way Mr. Osborne suggests that it underlies the attraction of visitors equally. You can read that in the way that now, tourists need to get into the rural areas and experience them as well. So I think either way, that objective is an acknowledgement that tourism will occur, does occur in the rural zone. So, and that's a positively stated objective, which in my submission is more helpful than these qualified ones. In my submission, Mr. Brown's revisions are in the nature of a refinement of the Council's provisions and are by no means an overhaul. As I mentioned, he's aggregated and reconstituted those objectives, and there are a series of policies that remain unscathed. And I just list here two other amendments that are made under 2.6 and 2.8, which is really a list for the panel's reference. I don't think you can read those out, just so you've got them there. So in terms of key aspects of the evidence, QPL considers that the council overstates the contribution that farming makes to rural character and landscape values, and the Smeerton considers that the characteristics of the rural landscape vary widely across the rural zone. We have good evidence of that effect from other parties. She agrees with the evidence of both Ms. Fluger and Mr. Baxter that it is the unique rather than the generic landscape character that should determine the level of development in the rural zone. As a consequence of the above, QPL also considers that the council overstates the contribution that farming makes to the district's tourism economy. And the panel may have noted that Mr. Greenaway has some sympathy for Mr. Osborne's primary assertion that landscape values are important to tourism, and I think that's to again undeniable. That's what farming does, that's the essence of our dispute with the council.
I'm pleased to hear that you're saying it's undeniable because others
well, I'm not a witness, so maybe it's better to take the views of the witnesses, but I think it would be hard for us to say landscape doesn't contribute to Queenstown's tourism field. Where Professor Hayling, whereas Professor Hayling is less enthusiastic about that proposition, i.e. how far you hate it and what are the other contributors to tourism, while he doesn't check that the popularity of the district to tourism in part rest and part of natural landscapes. However, does the Greenway and Professor Hagley both take issue with Mr. Oswald's reliance on farming? On farming is significantly contributing to landscape values that are attractive to tourists. So I just note here, it is a comment from an advocate rather than a witness, that tourists can watch livestock graze and experience golden pasture up and down the country. And there's no denying these pleasant drives through Central Otago when you see rolling country, but that's not necessarily unique to Central Otago. You can drive to the site south like Gatto, you can drive to the Hurepuna Plains, the Palms to the north and see large rolling expanses of pastoral land. So we take a position that we doubt tourists to come to Queenstown because they understand there is rolling pasture and sheep grazing. It's the landscapes, the memorable mountains, rivers, lakes, that are the landscapes that underpin tourism. So that's what I say, it must be the spectacular and memorable O&Ls and O&Fs that make the greatest contribution to Queenstown's uniqueness and its tourism appeal. These are mountain rivers and lakes, as Professor Hagley acknowledges in paragraph 6.1 of the statement of evidence. It is those landscapes that feature on tourism materials. In that regard, Ms. Smeathan makes the refreshingly logical observation that much of the mountainous O&L is protected from development due to its sheer scale and accessibility, and they are also, of course, protected by Chapter 6 of O&Ls. In terms of economic benefits, there seems to be no dispute that tourism is a key economic driver for the district. Professor Hagel then considers that there is thus a demonstrable need, which may become an urgent need, for provision of additional tourism and visitor services, perhaps especially innovative services, which, for example, would diversify the market seasonally and across different tourist types. Professor Milne's evidence addresses the proposed remarkable gondola as an example of significant tourist infrastructure in a rural zone and in an O&L that will deliver significant tourism benefits. Now, we've called Professor Milne because we thought the panel might be interested to get some sense of what that proposal might deliver in terms of tourism benefits at this point, and of course you'll hear about it in much more detail later on in terms of QPL's rezoning submission, but we hope that's of interest to the committee, and that's why we asked Mr. Milne, Professor Milne here today. We understood that might be some information in this issue. We know it's an opportunity, but picking up on the comments about the rule, we know you're an opportunity in Gondola today, but as an example of tourism infrastructure that we say you certainly shouldn't propose in the rural zone. Professor Milne's evidence addresses the proposed remarkable Gondola as an example of significant tourism infrastructure in a rural zone and in an O&L mentioned that. And as he describes it, the proposed remarkable Gondola experience will fit well with the deeper experiential dimension needed to enhance yield from existing and new markets. Adding value to the ski field visitor by cutting travel time challenges related to road transport while also deepening the range of all-season travel experience from non-snow sport visitors. And on the social well-being aspect, in a discussion yesterday with Professor Milne, gondolas are a very safe way of accessing mountain, and people have a variety of views about the safety of the current road to the remarkable ski field. But in terms of social well-being, the health and safety of your tourists and of your local residents are important, and gondolas are a safe method of transport to ski areas. Mr. Beale's evidence, ecological evidence, addresses farming and tourism from an ecological perspective. He addresses the ecological impacts of farming activity and concludes that traditional farming activities such as fire and tracking can lead to an extensive loss of shrubland cover and consequent loss of habitat and maybe fauna, lizards and invertebrates, including species of conservation concern. These activities can also accelerate the spread of weeds, causing a decline in habitat quality. He considers that recreational and tourism activities are more compatible with the retention and maintenance of shrubland than traditional farming activities. And to be fair to the panel, there's a balance of all that, of course, too, depending on the scale of the tourism activity and its footprint. So there will be a range of activities from lighter, softer recreation to something that's more extensive. But there's a balance in all that, that by no means should recreational or tourism activities be seen to be generating greater adverse effects on ecology or SNA than farm. So we've called Mr. Beale to speak to that particular matter. It is submitted that the evidence for QPL establishes that the council has overstated the contribution farming makes directly or indirectly to tourism. which is reflected in the objectives and policies proffered by the council. If the Brown provisions ensure that a reader of the district plan will be left in no doubt that commercial activities are an expected part of the rural zone, thereby acknowledging their importance to Queenstown's well-being. It bears emphasis, as I mentioned earlier, sir, that the council's proposed rules are not significantly altered by Mr. Brown, and commercial activities, in fact, commercial recreation activities in his rule, and also ancillary commercial activities. So we've proposed that you have recreation activities and then commercial activities that are ancillary to them. A cafe, perhaps a bike trail, and then commercial recreation activities as their own subset that are an amalgam of a recreation activity that you pay for. So the two activity types that Mr. Brown proposed to include under the discretionary activity rule. And there's a debate in that about whether it is better to just say commercial activities, because the assessment criteria, much like the back door for commercial activities, will limit the kind of commercial activities that arise in the rural zone. The policies talk about a genuine connection to the rural resource or the need for open space or land. Whether you just have commercial activities or whether you limit that definition of commercial recreation and ancillary commercial activities. I have a preference for fewer words, but the panel will need to assess whether it thinks the assessment that is a policy is strong enough to prevent commercial activity that might not be appropriate in the rural zone. So that's the only real rule that's put forward by Mr. Brown. And I note here that commercial activities remain a discretionary activity. Council's discretion is not restricted, it's not in the discretionary area. It can consider a wide range of factors and it can ultimately decline consent. However, it is QPL's view that it is important to put that the processing officer does not commence an assessment from the point of view that a commercial activity will most likely degrade the rural zone. Rather, the starting point of the commercial activity may be appropriate, but adverse effects must be managed. And finally, I note the council takes issue with the premise upon which he considers Professor Haberling's given the faith, and I think indeed UPL's case generally. Professor Haberling was given a very narrow brief, and that was to simply review and comment as an economist on the evidence of Mr. Osborne, and the reason for that was my impression that that evidence read much like planning evidence rather than economic evidence. So I simply wanted, and as Professor Haberling calls a humble economist, to look at that and say, what would you say about that as an economist? So that's what he has done, and I say quite clearly has noted that farming makes a minor contribution to the district's economy, it's a big contribution, and that the council is imposing a significant financial burden on farmers. In terms of the, so that you have to say potentially imposing a significant financial burden on farmers in terms of the ability to diversify land use and realise capital. And I had a discussion about that yesterday in terms of the rural lifestyle growth as well, extracting capital out of land. More critically, QPL's key contention, and that is that the council provisions do not appropriately encourage commercial activity, it is noted that objective 21.2.9 contains the qualifier that non-farming activities not intended on farming. Now I bring that to your attention because the council relied on that particular objective to say, we're doing exactly what QPL says, they've got it completely wrong, we're not discouraging farming. This objective says commercial activity. So they mustn't degrade the landscape, and there's other things they mustn't do, but one of them is contingent on farming. Now, I wonder how you could ever say that the use of rural land for something other than farming is not impinging on farming. If land is taken out of land supply, it might be used for that orthodox activity. So I think that's a very onerous policy in terms of relegating commercial activity quite clearly to some level below farming activity. You could say, if you take that land out of productive use for the bike track, it is no longer available for farming, and that is impinging on farming in the rural district. So that might be an interpretation we don't accept as a group here today, but one that a council officer might take for that policy. And so I think our view of those policies is quite clear when you look at those words. And that being so, it is submitted to the council's criticism of Professor Haberling's evidence, and of course QPL's position on what these particular policies mean is unfounded. Just turning to the slightly heavy, we're getting at other matters, but just to capture the other things we address in evidence. QPL seeks amendments to objective 12.2.6 for ski areas to provide connections to urban zones. We hear your comments, sir, on a rule and take that on board. And aligned to this is the definition of passenger lift system ski activity. And Mr. Brown also proposes a restricted discretionary rule for passenger lift systems. Now, this isn't in his main brief, it will be in his summary statement. I understand that Mr. Barr may have suggested, or may have commented that a restricted discretionary activity rule could be appropriate for those things, for a passenger lift system. And Mr. Brown turned his mind to that and developed a rule and a series of assessment matters that would enable passenger lift systems at NADA. And he will speak to that today. Objective 21 through 12, surface of water activities, we seek to amend that to provide for recreational, commercial recreational, and public transport activities. And chapter 33, there are amendments there to recognise recreation in terms of indigenous vegetation, which Mr. Beale will give us directly with, and all of those are recent evidence, but that's pretty checklist for the panel's use. So, which regime is better? That's the question. And of course, you've got other regimes other than that which QPL and the council have asked. And comparing those two, in my submission, it would be unreasonable to suggest that either the council's or QPL's proposed provisions are contrary to the purpose of the Act. The question for the panel in my submission is which better achieves the purpose of the Act. And I reflected on that overnight, sir, and this morning. I think, in terms of the economic imperatives, in Section 5 and the efficient use of natural and physical resources in Section 7, it's a strong call in terms of council provisions about whether they meet those imperatives, whether that the rules I'm saying is so restrictive or inhibits diversification to a point that they are not meeting those imperatives. That's a question to you. So I think that might be the only part of Part 2 where you could make a more striking submission that we might be heading in the direction that's contrary to those drivers. Of course, there are other imperatives under those parts of the Act that come into play. But I submit the QPL provisions are better because they better provide for the district's social, health and safety activity, as I mentioned, and economic, through tourism, economic well-being under Section 5.2. Better recognise the variation in landscape and rural character, thereby better achieving Section 6.B. Better protect areas of significant vegetation, Section 6.C, better enable the efficient use and development of natural physical resources, 7.B, better ensure that the energy values and the quality of the environment are maintained and enhanced, Section 7.C and F, and based on a more balanced assessment of cost and benefit, bearing in mind you don't really have a quantitative assessment of cost and benefit before you, but I'd say provide a more balanced assessment of those potential costs and benefits, and better enable opportunities for economic growth in terms of Section 32. And we will call evidence, and this is the order of witnesses, sir. We'll call Professor Timothy Hazelding, Robert Greenaway, Matthew Seddon, Professor Simon Beale, Professor Simon Noon, and Jeffrey Brown. I understand what we'll do is we'll call out five non-planning witnesses, and Mr. Brown has got a separate window to speak to a number of submitters as well. So, there's those of the submission I've tried to there's one final matter, so I think to raise with you perhaps off here. There's a wall, a building line restriction rule that I understand is spoken to by the QAC, which is over the top of the Delta and does slightly encroach on the into the QPL land.
Oh, that's and the speed. That wouldn't be out of control, don't it?
No, the building line restriction, I've just got the email set, the building, that's rule 21.4.36. The building line restriction, and
21.4.36.
4.36, sorry. That's how we've noted it now. Submission on balance to make sure that the number hasn't changed. Well, there's two things. There's a notation on a district planning map 31A for the building line restriction in the proposed plan that existed, but there was no complementary rule. There was no rule coming off that end. Now, as I understand it, we have a rule.
So I see the respond map 31A.
That's right.
And it seems to run across the
unformed road along the Parnell River and then slightly all the sort of few hills there.
Yes, so that comes into the land here and runs adjacent to the Michael's Park right now. Our contention, our submission asked in the operative plan, the notation was there, the wall wasn't, so we never knew, it had no effect in reality. Now we've got the rule that says that anything is non-compliant. Anything breach of that building line restriction is non-compliant. The question we have is, why is that? What is the resource management issue of concern that justifies that non-compliant status? Because this is quite different to
something more fundamental must be done. No one has addressed it since the why there should even be a building restriction
line
and there.
And you don't address it on the person seeking to restrict an activity to tell you why. And to say why it's there. But that's why there isn't any justification for it. We would rather it's not there, to the extent that it's got it and fringes on a few key hours land for no good reason as far as we're aware. And so I simply recall that's our submission. What we saw clarification as to what's its resource management purpose. I don't believe that's been addressed, so we remain in the position that it shouldn't be there, and the rule shouldn't be there either. Now, if there is a reason for it in terms of the delta and activity in the shot over delta, well, that's fine, but we haven't heard that. We can't understand why it needs to extend on a few deals there. But it's different. It's not an optical limitation script of those things are contained out where they are banished. It doesn't seem to relate to any operational aspect of the airport as far as we can see. So if there's those are...
Does QGL's submission provide scope to the mean of things? I have not put that.
We oppose it. So that's
right.
So that is an opposition.
Is that the rule or the... Provisional
map. Well, certainly it's on the rule. I'll check whether the authority is a notation on the map, so I don't know that. As you would have seen, well, a large submission on sort of administration scope or something.
It will take you some time
to realize that. So those are my submissions. Unless there's any questions, I'll propose to call those witnesses.
Could you identify for us? Which bits on map 31A are, if I could give the standard members a copy, if you could mark which bits of land are QPL?
Yes. I might just miss a copy of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I think our commissioner Sophia was seeking the entirety of the land.
Land. All the
QPL land.
Land. Bits within the...
That's not the bits within the...
There's other bits. The bits around the... Yes,
okay. Yeah. Maybe one of them. Just take that away and tell you what happened.
Yeah.
Yep.
So do you want all the QPL land?
Just to mark it up there.
The other point this card was made to me is also that there may be a desire to have pedestrian or bridge connection across that river to the QPL land being zoned for a mix of rural uses or commercial recreational commercial uses under the zoning. So I don't know what that building line restriction does in terms of any pedestrian crossing of the river. So if we get that to the point, you'll make sure that we don't know what it's there for, we can't work out the implications of it.
So, and just for clarification, the building line restriction was shown on the planning maps in the opposite plan, but there was no rule.
That's my understanding. Yes, that's my understanding. Wrong there, I'll clarify. Okay. Commissioner Sinclair, what I've done here is circled around your QPL plan and then I'll highlight in pink a boundary that's the there's a boundary of QPL plan in around this location, so you can see the lines on the map. That helps.
happen in terms of the submissions that you lodged in advance, Mr. Gray? You referred in there to the green and what the district council case and relied on that sort of case on page 10 for submissions.
Yes, in terms of
and yes, I was just wondering, given that that was essentially a consent order, how much reliance we can place on the court's comments in that. I'm hesitant to say decision.
No, I understand. I'm just thinking whether that was before they have the disclaimer on the consent order, where this is by consent and we haven't inquired for the merits.
It's more recent than that, it's Judge Smith.
Judge Smith, so you've been
quite difficult with the same rule.
Now, I was involved in the hearing. I know Judge Smith usually convenes, I don't know if it's the fact that he convenes what's like a formal proof hearing in terms of consent order to set through provisions. Look, I think your question is fair that it's not a decision in terms of a full hearing, but look, it is an example of where it's been approved by at least by experienced witnesses as well, sir, in terms of that proposal. But no, I take your point. The solution was proffered by consent.
That's my issue.
Just a quick question in relation to your paragraph 3.1. I think we were here yesterday morning when there was some discussion around the characterisation of the landscape across the district, and there's some specific issues around how the water tipping basin has been characterised. Your paragraph reads more widely than that. Does the concern of your client and your witnesses the way the entire district has been characterised, or are we restricted here to the works of the basin?
Certainly Ms. Meadham's concern is much wider, and she had a concern about the lack of a first principles assessment of landscape, and then we've gone back to the recent decision to see the genesis of these landscape lines, and for instance, Judge Jackson's decision on Northern Place, the remarkable, and I'm loath to criticize brevity in written decisions, but it's 9 pages with 2 witnesses, and that's been transferred through. So the short answer is Ms. Meadham looks much more widely and feels that even the ONLs, you've got a variety of different landscapes with different features, different characteristics that should be considered on a site-by-site basis or at least in the landscape unit basis. So yes, we go well beyond the water view basin. I mean, the question is whether all part of UPL's land is put in the basin as well. So yes, you aren't really wide and thing.
Thank you,
sir. So I'll make some room for them. I'll call Professor Hazel then. I'll hand over a summary statement.
Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning, Commissioners. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. I want to say on spirit of positivity rather than negativity, I won't say I was suffering from a cold. I'll say I'm getting over a cold. But I'm not quite there yet, so at least you can hear me, but if I ask you to repeat a question or anything, it's probably because I'm a bit younger.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to participate in this important matter at the Vista. And I'll be referring now, I may, to summary of evidence, which I will just read through. It's quite brief. I have at hand also, and we'll refer to the May 2nd statement, which was prepared by Simpson Grierson, on which criticisms of
the submissions of James
Lindsay for his counsel. Right, thank you. Which was the other referred to, and of course I have my own informed evidence at hand as well. Okay, in summary, I've provided the evidence on the current and future drivers of economic activity, in particular the Queenstown Basin and its environs and the QLDC. My main conclusions are as follows. First, primary agriculture is an unusually, and I'm talking compared with the other 60-some districts in New Zealand, contributor to the Queenstown and Lakes District and the district economy. Unusually, in fact, it's the smallest contributor of any of the non-seriously observant districts in this country, as I document in my evidence. Secondly, traditional pastoral farming in particular struggles to generate viable economic, private economic returns to farmers, and this situation is not proof, not a bad one, not cyclical, but unlikely to improve. Thirdly, farming, these public products do provide a very useful service, which an economist might call an externality or a public good, to others through their contribution to care and attractiveness of the landscape and environment of this district. Fourth, the given financial stress facing farmers in the district, which I don't think is going to be anyone's going to query, partial farmers anyway, it is implausible and unreasonable to expect them, the farmers, to shoulder the burden providing this important public good, unless I suggest that someone might find it cheaper if they got paid to do it by the council, or if failing that, if they were not permitted to make other uses of their land, bringing them some money. Other commercially viable activities, additional to farming, additional to farming. It is unclear to me from what I've read to what extent such diversification would necessarily, in and of itself, constitute a threat to the overall attractiveness of the district. Of course, I'm not expert in that. I was looking for expert guidance on that. I didn't even find it. It is likely, though not necessarily so, that such diversification, with farming and as other activity, would predominantly, I imagine, not be the manufacturing shoes or something like that. It would be into activities providing services to tourists and visitors and local people, because the provision of such services is an unusually large contributor to the district economy, and how, in this case, unusual means highest in the terms that I've measured in my evidence of employment in the sector of New Zealand districts, although there are some Westland and a couple of other districts, Kaikoura, which is pretty close, but it's higher than particularly the forest-based districts of Taupo and Rotorua. It's very hard. This is definitely the main economic activity of the QLDC. Provision of services for tourists and visitors. Simply, the popularity of the district, of the evidence, to tourists and visitors rests in part, of course, on the things we can see on this charming room, but multiplied by the many additional attractive services provided by firms and individuals in the tourism economy. However, the supply of tourism services has been stressed recently by rapid growth in demand, a problem, a nice problem to have, but a problem nonetheless, resulting in price increases documented, I'd say, by my sample of reading in Italian every time, which is every time I come down, daily in Italian every time, and in the Auckland Herald for that matter. And also, alongside price increases, congestion and other non-price ways of rationing the scarce product when demand exceeds or strains the supply. Ninth point, there is thus, I believe, a demonstrable need, which may become an urgent need, and I've been quoted on this already this morning by Mr. Young, for provision of additional tourist tourism and visitor services, perhaps especially innovative services, which, for example, would diversify the market seasonally and across the different tourist types, bearing in mind there's a whole huge cohort of people that are on the plane with me yesterday morning coming into this district who I didn't see even 3 or 4 years ago coming to visit outside New Zealand. Outside English would be well. Simply then, bringing everything together, a strong economic case, in my opinion, can be made for permitting, perhaps encouraging, environmentally responsible new tourism and attractions to be developed inevitably on some land presently in primary agricultural use. Primary agricultural use means here, not in processing agricultural use, it means farming. In my statement of evidence, I've provided quantitative and analytical evidence or argument analysis in support of those points, the above points I've just made. I noted in particular the tiny proportion of the QLDC labour force engaged in farming, even including viticulture, which is viable on the whole, the inherent difficulties of, in particular, pastoral farming in this setting, the reverse sensitivity and other issues that lonely farmers face in an area like this, the remarkably high proportion of the workforce involved, as I mentioned, in the sector, in the added value sector of tourism, and the pressures that popularity in the region face on a limited supply of facilities and infrastructure. Okay. Now, moving on to the representation of the prospective solutions, of May 2nd, shall sell for QLDC failed, in my opinion, to understand the purpose of my contribution to these proceedings. Quite expert economists, and Mr. Young has told you what I was asked to do. I was asked, in the first instance, to comment on the evidence of Mr. Osborne, and I found it, so I did, and I found it necessary to add a bit of my own analysis to that to provide what I thought was a usefully cogent economic brief. So, I think the QLDC council misunderstand that, perhaps understandably, because they weren't told what I was told to do. Quite three of the four complaints made in their paragraph 3.7 claim alleged misrepresentations on my part of council's actual or proposed positions with respect to its rural provisions. In fact, I do not anywhere in my brief, with the exception which I'm going to return to in a moment, I do not anywhere in my evidence offer any opinion on, in particular, the provisions of the proposed district plan, nor of council's QODC's current stance on these matters. What I have tried to do is assist council and commissioners by setting out, as the man called Mayor Humble promised, the economic conditions and prospects of the Queenstown district, which in particular point to the continued economic precariousness of pastoral farming, the unique strength of the tourism sector, and the dangers generated by this strength given the difficulties in expanding supply chain. Now, my exception, if I may, is that I did, 7.4 of my brain evidence, take issue with council employees, the bar, who promulgates the what I call the food at any cost view, sentimental view of farming, which I believe to be the best anachronistic, and certainly it is the strict in this condition now. And that has actually does sneak into the representations made by Mr. Winchester, and that's in a phrase or sentence already quoted this morning by Mr. Young. Proposed revised objective 21.2.9 of the Rural Chapter states that, quote, a range of activities are undertaken on the basis of the law, degrade landscape values, whatever, rural energy excellence, will impinge on farming. and civil creativity. And I agree that with Tian and others have talked to that they actually favours farming. And we do so in planning in its execution or interpretation by Council of Canada. And I don't think it's excessive. I don't think farming should have any, as I say in my evidence, that using land to feed people should have no moral or sentimental status above using land to house people or even using land for people to have fun. I don't see that, especially in this district, useful for the future of the district. Okay, back, if I may, into my summary. So I haven't said that, I can't say anything about the district plan, but the section just noted. If it is the case that council is in fact or actually supportive of the policy implications of the economic position I have set out, then well, I would take that. It's sincerely, it's very good news. And I'm going to be pleased if we have any assistance in actually enforcing this. So this is very much of a positive spirit that I think this young is enjoying. I do, however, want to protest against one specific assertion by council, which is paragraph 3.4. Quote them to suggest, because the perception of their brief or evidence statement, which basically criticizes my colleague Martin Cotton, the economist, and me. And they write, to suggest, therefore, that the council is, quote, discouraging tourism activity or other non farming uses from utilizing the rural land to do what is wrong. Commissioner, I was surprised to see that word discouraging in quotes, but I did not believe I had used it, and I've got a search on my document and also on Mr. Copeland's, and neither of us used that word or any part of that word, like discourage and discourage, can be found not in our submissions. And I just think that that's an important word, and to put an important word like that in the mouth of a witness, maybe Mr. Copeland, it's not, in my opinion, up to the usual high standards of social biases. Finally, then, I take issue also with the third of the four complaints in their paragraph 3.7, the only one that's relevant, in my view, that my evidence lacks a reasonable basis to suggest that what attracts tourists to the district and drives the local economy is the local hospitality and services, I think they're now missing that sector, rather than the natural environment. Of course, the Queenstown tourism industry is built up on the foundations of the attractive local natural environment. But, as the data show, it has gone far beyond this, the tourism industry, the Queenstown industry. Far further, for example, than have the tourist industries of the arguably even more beautiful natural landscapes of surrounding Lake Wanaka and Lake Bukati and other areas of comparable natural beauty. And I submit, that's the right word, that this is indeed a reasonable basis for my evidence. Thank you.
Professor Hazel, you on that last point. Paragraph 8.7 of your evidence, as we discussed there, is it possible, and there you talk about change over 50 years, is it possible also that a contribution, a significant contribution, has been the change in accessibility of Queenstown, both domestically and internationally in that period?
Thank you, Commissioner. It probably is. So what's interesting? Yes, indeed. The answer is yes. The planes are coming in now, and they didn't come in 50 years ago to the same extent, which is off by Lucas and a couple of others. Why are the planes coming in to Pokaki and Wanaka? In other words, I think the planes are coming in because the tourism industry has come and developed attractions to bring the people in. And the attractions are no greater in their natural form, unless, like, amateur do if you like, but than they are in those ocean places, and
I think a few residents of Queensland might take issue with that comment.
Oh, they're worth taking
issue.
The one I put my hand up, and the one I have to break
I'm not making any comment. I live in Monica.
which two of you did, isn't it?
I'm just also in paragraph 8.14. In the last sentence.
Sorry, 8.14
of your sustained evidence. Of your evidence and
share. 8.14, sorry. Oh, yeah, thank you.
8.14, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
In the last sentence, you talk about increasing the quality of your experience, etc. I'm just wondering, that seemed to be in the context of improving road congestion, and I couldn't quite understand that linkage.
Road congestion? Well, road congestion is referred to as previous paragraph.
It has
a totally inefficient and wasteful way of adjusting demand and supply. Prices accumulate, is it? Having people queue and congest and spoil their experience is a bad thing. So additional attractive activities would actually increase the road congestion as well.
I'm just wondering if there is actually any relationship
between congestion.
I'm just wondering whether increasing attractiveness has a relationship to growing the congestion.
Yeah.
And whether it's positive or negative.
I'd say at the moment it's positive, sorry, negative, it's increases congestion, positive in the sense it makes it larger.
Yes.
And I probably want to lead on there to the sorts of things that have been talked about, of trying to spread the demand around it, seasonally in particular, which perhaps rather than for me. But fair enough, it's going to.
So in increasing the temporal range of the attractiveness is also part of that, what you're suggesting.
That would be, I believe, a very useful part of a future strategy for the district. And I think putting the pipe up to choking off some demand, which the private sector is already doing.
Yeah, the other one is it's not in your evidence, but I'd like your opinion as an economist. You've heard evidence from others who are not economists that there is potentially a substantial benefit to the local community and economy by the community servicing essentially holiday homes by looking after their gardens and maintaining them while the owners are not here.
Yeah.
Is that if you like a growth industry that would didn't have a long term benefit to the district?
If people willingly engage in this activity, it's for a private benefit. I don't have any other.
Is it a
strategic industry, as you might say?
Yes, but I'm wondering in terms of the quantitative benefit compared to other activities that could be undertaken.
Okay, so is it a small about a third of the houses around here each month. So they're the ones that have to have some look after their walls.
Yes.
So it must be quite a industry, right? So, would it increase? Probably not going to be a growth industry, because I don't see that the purchase of second homes in Queenstown is going to be a growth industry, because they're going to keep those kids. But I might be wrong about that. I haven't been there long.
Okay.
I'm interested in digging a bit deeper for the strategic chapter, criteria states that the aim is around diversifying the economy. And it seems to be within the remit that you're talking about diversifying the tourism economy,
yeah.
Rather than the economy in totality. You also highlight some of the problems with tourism, and I guess we see it every day in the new program, so I like it. From your perspective, is continuing to support tourism and focus on that completely the way to actually achieve that diversity in terms of the economic outcomes? And if you talk about the economy in terms of resilience around changes to the economy.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Lawton. That's a very interesting issue. I wouldn't think diversification is going to be the name of the game for this strategy in this town. Can you suggest what sort of things, apart from tending out of town and caravan, that you could diversify into? We could, as a district.
Well,
you're the expert.
We talk about it a lot in the district about
diversifying
the economy, and I'm wondering
if you have any. So, this is very interesting. People might have an idea that they must diversify into making shoes or what? What do they say?
I'm not sure
that
manufacturing
is
possible,
but. Quite a large source of diversification.
So there's certainly the discussion around technology, diversification, IT.
Yeah.
People talk about innovation centres where you're developing new businesses. They had the bigger towns discussion on the increased capacity around communication connections and all that kind of thing.
And possibly education as well, possibly?
Definitely, yeah.
So these are things which are wild, basically, so people can engage in these activities, certainly the IT type things, without anywhere they like, and if they, and it would be nice if they did in Princeton. Yeah. And there's a bit of that, quite a bit of that going on, I imagine, and the question for council is whether they should subsidize, or another way, encourage, is that what you're suggesting? And the goal of diversification, getting more resilient economy. So if the Chinese and the Indian and the parts stop coming, there's nothing else to do. Is that sort of a summary of why reason people might be interested in diversification?
And the question comes back to the terms of land use. You say that there's a lot of emphasis on farming, but then switch that to emphasis on tourism. For the sake of that's what we currently do, let's keep doing it and do more of it, even though there's the externalities in terms of social, economic, environmental. Coming back to you in terms of that economic future for the district, is that a good way to go?
Okay. I think it's a very good question to ask and reasonable thing to explain to me to consider, yes. One seems to say, look, what this region is really good at is collecting tourists, and sort of put a little truck on that. It certainly looks at the moment that that's a smart strategy, but then 4 years ago, all the smart money was going to dairy, wasn't it? And that didn't go down so well. So, there's a little reasonable point on which I haven't given consideration. But sure, I think it's a reason.
Thank you. is the freeway.
Well, I hope you resolve it under a humble parliament. Mr. Bindy. My evidence considers the role the rural zone and the Queensland Lake plays in supporting tourism and why this place should be recognised and provide the tourism and recreation activities in the rural zone to a greater extent than it is currently proposed. Specific recommendations and amendments to the PDP are made in submission of QDL. My evidence provides background to the commission. In my evidence, I describe certain activities which have very low impact on landscape and other values in rural settings and which should be supported by the provisions of the CDP. I agree with the review of Mr. Philip Osborne as provided in his evidence that the landscape of the district underpins its value as a source of consideration, especially considering that a large proportion of the district's most significant valuable tourism activities occur in the proposed rural zone, providing access to, for example, most of the Shoto River, offering, for example, jet boating, driving tours, bungee jumping, the land providing access to the district means significant annual settings such as the Upper Cooper River, Kauria and Lake Wanaka with tens of thousands of visitors per year, down to Quarry National Park and all walking time and tracking options within nearby including the start of the route in track. Almost all the land occupied by the 120km Queenstown Trail can be one more, with almost 700,000 walkers and cyclists using the current track between opening and the end of 2016. 214,000 for the 2015 year, another top of walking tracks. Golf courses such as Frankston, Arrowtown, Jack, Corn and Wanaka, covered with some designations from official zones. Capitalising on activities such as these may require additional infrastructure that can be sympathetically developed in a rural setting. For example, this might include conversion of or additions to existing farm buildings to provide accommodation for example, bike trail users and associated food and bike rental services and payments. New trails and tracks for recreation access and associated facilities such as food, toilets and shelter, which may have commercial elements. Facilities and services to support, for example, game hunting, equestrian trails, passes and park land. My experience with such development proposals as park and stage reserves and hill ends, for example, the consenting process and oversee consideration of their costs and benefits. I quote the PDP and its expectation of maintaining the quality of the rural setting, or, amongst other things, their contribution to tourism value is therefore in line with Mr. Osborne. However, there is a dubious logic in how they are farming above all other users, as those other users can achieve the same outcomes in terms of less important land access. A cycle trail and farm road has no important differences. A small farm building of less than 100 square metres and 4 metres in height and an O&L is permitted. I do not see why similar options for children should be significantly treated by non-compliant status. In that regard, I've also found sympathy for the views of Professor Hazelby. The farming activity per se does not make a significant contribution to Queenstown tourism appeal, but that the land is based on the ability to do activities and quality social, commercial and landscape settings. I consider that the QPL gondola proposal represents a strategic asset for tourism in the district and is appropriately located for the following reasons. It provides an efficient means of setting and capitalising on existing tourism infrastructure that's in the market area. It is located in an area very proximate to the airport where high levels of service to tourism are expected and where international comparisons of standards of service will be made. It enhances high value short stay tourism by increasing the ease by which domestic and Australian visitors can seek and access a ski weekend in response to emerging Asian markets which are less likely to take in the end of road transport to Syria. Based on my review for QPL, it has very limited potential for adverse effects on existing tourism assets, such as the Queensland Trails, and users of the Toro and Shopping Rulers, and will have no adverse effect on assistance numbers and other tourism activities. It is, in my sense, merely modern means of transport for a rural area, and a part of the system and visual impact on the road would be in such settings. Occupies a relatively small footprint and allows rural activities to continue to stay in rural areas. Which really might be a good question.
Thank you, Mr. Greenway. I had a section highlighted in the statement of evidence, and I see you've included in the summary at paragraph 5, we say, however, there's dubious logic in elevating farming above all other uses, if those other uses can achieve the same outcome in terms of most importantly landscape effects.
Yes.
Is shipping it in off and then get hard ship, of course. I guess we're here to discuss the rural chapters and the traditional and historical use of that rural land has always been for farming. Are you suggesting that there's another type of zoning or another way to approach the rural land or the land outside of an urban area for other reasons than those original, traditional, historical uses?
I wouldn't say that the rural land has been the preserve of agriculture. It's always been a significant recreation setting for New Zealand in terms of hunting and driving and cycling and passes and the like. So it's always been a recreation setting. It's a means by which now that it is managed in such a way that it supports larger scale sort of thing. I'm not suggesting in a little statutory manner either a separate zone, but that within the rural zone the qualities of the landscape are recognised for their importance, their contribution to experience, but that the rules do provide for a landowner to consider diversifying their means of making the economic return from that land in such a way that the landscape values are the same. And with recreation and tourism in rural settings, you are enabling people to experience that rural setting by increasing access and providing the services that tourists rely on. So in a sense, you're going through and saying, okay, we've got this one rural landscape which we're trying to protect tourism, but we're making it a challenge or a high challenge for rural landowners to actually develop sort of methods. You're denying people the right to actually go through and occur those particular steps. So my approach is just to go through and say that if you do have, for example, the opportunity to convert a farm building from a farm use to a tourism use, and in effect the net scale and actual values of slide, then you know, why make it a multiplying it seems to be fettering a very simple opportunity to develop economic return and to enhance people's ability to experience the rural landscape.
Okay, thank you. And just a sort of a broader question outside of the interests of your specific client PSA, what do you see being the greatest opportunity for the
Queensland
Lakes District in terms of future recreational opportunities?
Well, I'd probably be investing in if I had a detail on that one. But there's two avenues to go down. One of them is actually centralising controlling gas tourism, so that is the longer of the capacity transit. So to go through and say that you will have mass markets for a year for a short period of time who are more likely to pay a lot more on a per day basis. But they expect a very high level of service, they expect efficiency, professionalism, and they want to get through their list in as short and effective time as possible. So providing equipment for gondola to the markets is a perfect example of that, where you can corral people effectively, get them through experience quickly, get them to the quality setting, build them well managed, and you limit their effects on the environment because they really are within a controlled program. And you know, people give a lot of time to commercial tourism and national park guided tours and that sort of thing. But those people are actually the ones that have very low impact. They might be in a lot of people, but they're using the toilet, you know, they are doing the right things to exercise. And the other thing is going through and providing for the free and independent travellers and people who do want to stay more and have a great guest experience, I guess. And that, the focus on cycle trails in the country is just a person, you know, product for that market. But they want to get through a landscape and experience landscape at an intimate level. So sticking them on roads and gondolas
yeah, it may do for the 10 or 20 percent of their experience, but they do want to be in Marengo, and so perfect one for the rural side is to have create the ability for them to experience the small scale element of the landscape, which is that little tree, that little clump of trees close up, not seeing it from the top of the peak as a carpet in the distance. So I think we're pretty much doing what's being done now. But the challenge now is considering we are going to have, I can't remember what the number of Avon reward visitors were at one time, was it 500 at the time? I think, turning up, and that's a big tour party to get through. And we need a good, efficient setup to make that work. And the cycle car is not going to work for that market, but it's obviously good.
Thank you. Just for an idea, you could say that that farming on rural land and recreation tourism do complement each other?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is a matter of managing the effects. It's not assuming that one is going to have a worse scale of effect than the other. It is, if we are applying to put a cycle trail through a setting, and I've just been 2 weeks ago at the Royal Court here and see around the mountain cycle trail here, that somehow this is an activity that is significantly different from a land perspective of putting a farm road through and culverts, bridges and the like. In fact, there because of the deals that they were going through in terms of getting a container discussion, far better managed than the farming activity would be in there. So, a sediment control and the waterway and the like. So, it's not treating tourism as some bogey in that setting. It's treating it as an effective intent to use on it, but recognising, as the problem does, that the landscape values are important and they shouldn't be compromised, but they needed to be compromised by assuming that tourism is going to be a great one.
I guess just considering what happens to rural land if it isn't being farmed and it converts back to some shrubland that with all forms which keep landscapes, and there's a variety of ways that the ownership model could work in terms of how tourism would work on that land or operate on that land. Do you think that tourism operators can care for the land to retain landscape values that we talked about in terms of rural zones?
The rural landscape. Well, in terms of being able to afford to stay on the land, being able to diversify your product is very important. I mean, if you've bought a large chunk of turf, you just want to have borders on it, and that's sort of done through, then you're not necessarily churning out wool, but you are churning out green grass to look at, and shell develops and colour poppers and that sort of going on, quite active. So it is a means of diversifying product and being able to sustain yourself on the land. But I mean, of course, that's a personal decision as to how someone treats the land. They could go a buyer and say that I'm not going to farm it, I quite like, well, maybe harvesting roses. That could be an economic activity, but it's not going to be grass. So it's a little bit more like the standard, you know, wheat standard. So.
And finally, in terms of the recreational opportunities that the particular project might open up, as a gondola talked about the MAC group, but it's also to a ski field and there's other recreational opportunities, what do you think some of those things that the gondola may actually enable?
Oh, I mean the fact that, you know, flying down the hill and great sea, and great lips, great fun of course. But people don't need to do all the stuff. In fact, because this summer my family and I went up to Rupay on the lift. And it's just been in that landscape in a summer period with a bit of snow wandering around. You don't actually need to throw a lot of resource in there, but you do want to buy a property and you do want to be able to walk off not the peak that much, but well, you know, potentially off the sort of cafe area and just be in the land base. So you don't know if things to go overboard. Because the feeling for people that are living at the start is different from what I was experiencing today. I've been saying coming out to the cannabis and can't get out. So for instance, here we got into the first cannabis, had a couple of dead sheep and very little grass. So she was from Central London and she'd just never been in that landscape. And for her that was just a life changing thing. So yeah, you don't need to go overboard with providing that, because you are putting people into quite a remarkable So one other thing just on that. Just the access to the rural landscape, when we were talking about diversifying economic basis for Queenstown. The providing for locals is really critical, and locals like to engage in their local landscape. So seeing that not so, when we talk about recreation and tourism and commercial recreation, we have recreation is what we do when we shop in spare time. Use that definition. Tourism is what you do when you stay away from home for a night, and commercial recreation is the services that serve both tourism and recreation. So for people to come here and want to run an IT shop or whatever, they need to be attracted here because it's a great place to live. And having a forward many activities that locals can do in many different settings is really important, because they just don't want to walk around and like everything today. They want to do a whole lot of different stuff. So diversifying your access through the rural landscape and giving people a feeling that they are able to get there in a better way, so it's really important to give people a reason to be here to then diversify that economic space.
Can you
talk
about the
Very important.
Paragraph 6 of your summary, you refer to the TPL gondola proposal. What is the TPL gondola proposal?
Across the Coral and up into Remarkable Cathedral.
Does anyone have a plan?
No, I apologise. That's reached with me. It is in the Queenstown Park rezoning area of a proposal to have a gondola line to go up. We haven't gone to that detail either. Professor Milne perhaps speak to it, but we've mentioned it as a piece of tourism infrastructure that's proposed, a little bit of benefits of it. But Professor Milne could talk about more detail about what that is. Where we don't have a plan, we don't have a layout for you here, but we can provide like a talk one time if there's any skills to make them want to sit. It's more of an example than a business project.
Just beyond this question. The green plan that Queensland Park provided was through that information on this submission, which does need to be re-notified.
Yes.
Perhaps if that planning was paid for Commissioner St. Clair, that would assist them to understand what we're talking about.
Yes, and I think that shows a corridor.
It shows a corridor.
Yes. So I think we can provide that assistance.
Like your evidence in your summary in regard to gondola only apply to the gondola proposed here or to passenger lift flight systems that would be considered through the entire district in terms of how the plan might provide for that?
I've only specifically looked at the QPO proposal. In terms of what effect it could have on other tourism activities. But my role in terms of assessing that is to have a pretty much what could be bad news for it, of added effects on existing recreation tourism activities in that area. So that bit is specific to QPL proposals. But in terms of a passenger lift system, you know, replacing a road with an alternative for a road or providing for markets that don't like driving up roads or terrified of being even in a bus going up a successful road, those are all just generic things that require good sense.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We might have another question.
Thank you. Thank you, Phil. Overall, my review of the rural landscape suggests that while there are common generic rural characteristics as underlined in the tree, in the RC, the rural landscape characteristics is more complex and determined by a unique combination of landform, land cover, and land use to convey a range of distinct spaces. And the evidence both in the Kluge and in the Smith-Back to recognise that it is a unique rather than generic landscape character, as Ms. Jan pointed out. That should determine the level of development appropriate for various rural landscapes within the district. I agree. What may be an important attribute in one rural landscape may not be identified as such in another, and if the identification of these different within rural character and associated values, it will enable development to be assessed in relation to the values for which protection is sought or must be managed. I agree with Reid's summary statement, paragraphs 1 and 2, and her reports relating to the landscape classification boundaries. And I'm not convinced that the landscape classification boundaries reflect the complexities relating to rural character, so I identify the quality and significant values associated with the district's rural landscape. I remain to the opinion that a district-wide landscape study would assist in establishing a baseline for consideration of the effects of proposed development. Whether effects are adverse or not depends to a large extent on what is valued and considered appropriate, and the public expectation of what can be reasonably anticipated to occur in the landscape. In my opinion, activities other than farming could occur in the rural zone without appreciably changing the existing rural character, quality, and more efficiently values. My evidence considers that particular types of development may benefit the landscape values associated with the rural landscape and contribute to or enhance rural character or rural amenities, including increasing recreation access and tourism of the natural landscape, increased exotic tree plants for rural landscape, not necessarily on else, and increased biodiversity through adding indigenous vegetation for rural landscapes, including on else, and covering areas with restrictions of special development rights. An example of an appropriate activity other than farming is the Tenpai Partner of the Gondola, close to an alternative access to the Maipua ski area, and as a tourism activity in their life. Mr. Greenway's evidence further confirms the development potential of the rural landscape in relation to recreation and tourism with reference to the experience of Celine and Parkin Bay in the station proposal. This development is a good example of the type of farm cars listed above, so they encompass some form of recreation activity, social facilities, residential accommodation, a comprehensive revegetation program in combination areas. This confirms that despite changing character, a range of alternative uses of farm properties may be undertaken while maintaining desirable rural qualities and status of the landscape. My review of the proposed objectives and policies and assessment methods has led to my opinion that the proposed official plan provisions could be improved by requiring a district-wide assessment for landscape study to establish a baseline for varying and unique range of rural character and rural values in the district, including the identification of the effects and capability of the landscape and or effectiveness to change to ensure the landscape is managed and effective.
recognising that other activities such as tourism and commercial recreation may be restricted in the rural zone rather than exclusively relying on pastoral funds to maintain the rural landscape. It is important that the focus can recognise that open systems is where the key value of the rural landscape and that it ensures a consistent use of technology relating to open systems. First, the open character. It restricts the ability of farmers to sustainably manage their rural land and is inside the detriment of maximum biodiversity. My view, there will be value in addressing the national prescriptive values and is recognising a hierarchy of values to reduce the tension between open and
closed.
Thank you, Ms. Field.
Any other
questions? Paragraph 5.3, which is where we can change to discussing the range of mangroves that occur in the Washington Basin. And it seems from your paragraph 1 that you're focused on the Washington Basin for your analysis, is that correct?
Yes. But the district
in general as well.
I'm
more familiar
with the Washington Basin, I suppose,
and
maybe
want to have one here. Could you then just check what you've read, what you've written, what you've listed in paragraph 5.3 and confirm that all of those places are actually in the Washington Basin?
Well, they may not necessarily all be in the Washington Basin.
Well, that's the sentence says that.
Yeah. I think I've probably, I guess my idea of the Washington Basin is probably may differ from what is actually outlined in the standing there. So I'm it probably should be the district.
So if you change that to the district, then
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Stillen, and thank you in particular for your photographs. It's amazing how many beasts of landscape evidence we've had out of the last couple of weeks with an absence of photographs or maps. The provision of a sort of view location map will often help with understanding where those views are taken from. I know it's included in the best practice guidance for the NZILA, but it's a potential photos.
Yes,
so
normally I would.
Is that what you would like? No, it's fine. It's easier to find your way around and understand what you should know which part of the trip you're at. In relation to the question about Mr. Young and the approach as legal submission, did you put a federal board concern with the entire district because your paragraph 1 confirms that you're looking more closely at the Washington Basin?
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to look at the characterisation, for example, the other close to the basin?
No.
No.
No, I think that's what they do.
Yep, so we're squarely in the water situation here. Okay, thank you. And just saying in your evidence summary, in the paragraph 9, you mentioned the desirability for a first principles landscape study. I had some discussion with Mr. Goldsmith on this yesterday. In a unique situation with 17 years of case law and lines being drawn by judges, and we've got some pretty seminal case law that comes out of this district that tells us how we should go about that. Firstly, I'm wondering if that situation is unique enough to require to lead us towards a methodology which has been undertaken by Dr. Reed, which is more of a composition of what's been done over the last 10 or 10 years as opposed to starting afresh. Do you have a view on that?
I don't think you need to start afresh, and I think what Tana has raised up is really useful, and as you say, there's a huge body of information out there. It's just that, in my experience, coming in, and if I was doing an assessment or a development proposal, it's not all in one place. You've got to delve through quite a lot of different documents, and it's not clear for me. And also I also have a slightly uncomfortable about the methodology that's being used, because there are so many different landscape practitioners involved. And on one hand you could say, well, that's quite a good thing because, you know, that's pretty much all in agreement except really not. And I also note that Ms. Reed says that her assessment of and I think that's where a lot of people or landscape architects feel a little bit uncomfortable, because it's maybe not quite robust enough to and defensible enough, and I think that's popping up when you do a case by case analysis of landscape.
Yeah, I guess we're seeing a pattern across the country of districts and regions kind of rolling over certain elements of either a district plan or previous landscapes that have been identified, and I guess you're paying some respect to the history of what's been done in the past.
Yeah, I wouldn't disrespect it at all. Yeah. And as I said, I think it's very useful. But in my mind, I'm thinking about the next National Landscape Study, for example, which is it's a very graphic document that stacked up with good description for landscape. That is what it is. It's the description. Then it's the characterization. Then it's the evaluation. It's all very clear. With a landscape character unit, it's all very easy to understand for any practitioner who is using the district plan, which, I mean, I'm assuming that we want it to be user friendly and understandable and unambiguous and not confusing and so on. So to my mind, I think that would assist, and maybe it would help address just some of the discomfort surrounding some of the
information. Okay, if that process has been undertaken, do you think it would be likely to result in about 3 different lines for the ones that we've got in terms of O&L boundaries?
I think some would possibly change. I mean, there are some lines that include areas of landscape that I think, I don't think they would recognise it as an O&L. It's highly modified does it pass the outstanding this week, does it pass the next one this week, or an O&L? There may not be major changes, but they may be quite major for the landowners involved and the way forward for the the future.
Okay, thank you. In your EMA statement of evidence, that paragraph 5.13. Sorry, what's that? 5.13. You've got the next couple of paragraphs written in the 5.15. You discussed Mr. Baxter's comparative characterisation, if you like. So, in his statement of evidence, he looks at Dr. Reed's characterisation of the loss of occupation and then undertakes his own. Just at the end of that paragraph 5.15, are you saying there that there you're adopting Mr. Baxter's characterisation of the loss of occupation?
Well, for the most part, yes, and particularly where he's talking about which means.
Underlying natural processes and landforms, and that he sort of put stronger emphasis on the domesticated land characters and the cultural overlays over the top of that.
Mm.
And I think he considered that between the two of them they have covered.
That just indicates the varying range of rural characters and the landforms that there are.
In the upper Clutha being the two main flat areas of land?
If I'm correct in where I think that you're referring to, I would think that there is a difference. Yeah, that the Clutha area is much more open than less treed, if you like, than the
Washington Bay. Okay, thank you. Oh, and just perhaps an unfortunate twist of timing, but your paragraph 6.4 sort of highlights the importance of the lady's mile.
I knew you were going to bring that up.
I'm not picking on you, but it's just, I guess it's a question around the speed with which change occurs in the district. You know, especially with the weight of national SHA legislation coming down on the lady's mile, potentially. Is there any way that you can see that we can protect ourselves in a landscape sense in terms of what we're trying to do with the district plan from that sort of that sudden speed of change?
In terms of requiring setbacks and maintaining trees longer. To me, it comes back to robust and defensible landscape study, and if you identify those values associated with Lady's Mile, then that would then any development proposal would be assessed against that.
Okay, but perhaps for that piece of iconic road, setbacks and trees are critical.
It's what certainly sticks in my mind, the value of that.
Okay.
perhaps lobbying the government about all we can do.
Thank you, those one.
No, I won't. Perhaps I will. There was a matter I raised yesterday with Mr. Felsman, and I alluded to it this morning when he was pursuing his submissions about, and I think your evidence is suggesting that the floor of the Washington Basin is in need of study. Is that?
I think so.
And from your point of view as a landscape architect, you think the floor of the basin needs a proper landscape assessment?
I think there are areas within the walls of the basin that can take a full development and others that probably can't. And where the walls come from the two shafts and all that. And I think it would really help to change that.
So the matter I raised with Mr. Olson was whether we, as a panel, suggested to the council that they commence work on a structure planning process for the Pacific Basin. Would you agree with that sort of approach? Because that would inherently involve that sort of landscape analysis to underpin that work before moving on to putting the planning overlay to give effect to it.
I can see it could be very useful in one way, and maybe not so in another, and that it may restrict people or not consider any all developments that may be proposed in the future, or it depends on what. I mean, I know what a structured plan, in my mind, I know what a structured plan would look like, but I'm not quite sure of a structured plan that you're proposing, what it would look like.
Well, I'm not sure what it would look like, but my familiarity is, for instance, with structured plans that have been applied around Auckland, for instance, Long Bay. Structured plan is one of those things to mind that I was involved in. They're quite comprehensive and look at all the aspects. Not just landscape, but also the various other matters of the land, ownership patterns, the interests of the residents and the surrounding residents. That's a perhaps.
It could open a can of worms, but it could be very useful. I think it's, at the end of the day, you'll still be doing landscape study based on these principles, I would hope, and that would be useful.
Okay. So, just a continuation of that question, what has come through fairly in the strength of hearings is that most landscape experts are agreeing that there is a difference in character in the Washington Basin and the rest of the district, and also perhaps that the way that it's been described in the landscape studies behind the PEP is up for interpretation. So I guess we're not suggesting a first principles of landscape assessment as such, but maybe a re-look at the character of the Washington Basin and emphasize the important issues about the areas that could absorb additional development rather than a broad brush application of a rural lifestyle zone, which has no subject to nuance with it.
And my concern would just be that it's robust enough to be sensible, and that it's not necessarily just the landscape architects that have the expertise to do a comprehensive landscape study. And so if you're including natural science factors and you're including cultural values, kind of similar and all those sorts of things that
encompasses and
particular factors, then
it's to be comprehensive
enough.
Yes, I think there's a fair chance, given the composition of the panel, that we would not be looking purely oriented after the
I'm going to resist not commenting on that. Because I'm thinking, I think one issue might be how hard and fast the structure plan is in terms of what does it indicate in terms of activity data for activities within an identified area, and then whether the land area is so fast that, you know, for the old days of the ARC, being a policy statement there was a structure planning exercise that would be undertaken by individual landowners to step through the hoops and do the assessment we're talking about. I know there's a concern and things done about private individuals planning, so private landowners doing ad hoc planning. So whether the structure, whether you had a plan that enabled a structure planning exercise to be taken to land holdings that looks to be on the site, to join the site and those sorts of things. Because we want to give it a debate, I imagine, the structure planner also.
We're having one of those anyway.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
That's what makes a difference from that sense.
And just how hard and fast that structure can be in terms of opportunities or restrictions for retention. So I don't understand which practices are like for it.
That was the only question I had.
Thank you, sir. I'm called Simon Field, it's a I don't know if you want to take a break. I know we're running out of the issue at the time, but...
Can I just check the pod? Were you hoping to join my one?
I appreciate you going to get on with it. I'm interested in the discussion that's going on, so...
Well, I think we'll hear Mr. Beale and then take a break.
Let's talk to Mr. Beale.
Shrubland that remains today are important in terms of the ecological services they provide, most notably reducing erosion and maintaining soil quality. A large proportion of the shrubland cover is contained within four SNAs, which remains highly restricted spacious. I noticed the chapter 33 provisions of the proposed plan envisage some developments in the SNAs. The proposed plan provides for sheep grazing within SNA. Sheep grazing is considered to have a low impact on shrubs and may in some areas be beneficial in terms of controlling invasive herbaceous weeds. Some traditional farming activities, however, do not maintain or enhance the SNAs and can pose a threat to the ecological values inherent to the SNAs. Traditional farming activities such as fire and tracking can lead to an extensive loss of shrub and cover if not properly managed. Consequent loss of habitat for 84 animals and vertebrates, including species of conservation concern. These activities can accelerate the spread of worms causing a decline in habitat quality. Opportunities for maintenance of shrubland and cliff based plantings is most likely to be achieved through the prevention of fire and avoidance of farm trapping activities, especially. Avoidance of these activities is more likely to allow for natural regenerative or traditional grazes to occur unimpeded and lead to a dominance by the indigenous species over what is a herbaceous exotic species, or at least coexist with the period that took that coexistence to prior. The management of shrub and can achieve through programs and weed and pest control measures. The extent to the shrub and road landforms that occur mostly in the Western Asia, in my opinion, aren't the spread naturally as you said, but maintenance of the places that we are appreciating, providing opportunities for recreational tourism and food. The shrub is contributing significantly to the setting of our schedule. Recreation and tourism activities are more compatible with retention and maintenance of shrubs than the traditional primary activities. While provision of activities such as mountain biking and water require construction of narrow trails or placement of poles or waratahs and route markers, the ecological effect of constructing trails with a minor compared to construction of farm tracks that involve less vegetation materials. Narrow trails are needed to align right here with the ecological value and are needed to rehabilitate. I understand that matters raised in my submission have not been addressed by the Council's economy in this submission and are not in this submission. Thank you, Mr. Beale, for the answer to your question.
You made a distinction in the statement of evidence, the difference between cattle and merino grazing.
Yes.
And your effect on the ecological values on the QPLA. Can you explain to me what currently happens in terms of stock management on the station?
I'd have to defer to Mr. Porter on that, but certainly in my visits to the area, particularly the Owen Creek, there is merino sheep grazing and cattle grazing occurring in that area. From what I observe is the sheep occur in a higher altitude range.
A bit higher altitude,
higher range. Higher altitude, but I'm pretty sure at the higher range.
Mr. Porter, if I can hold it off, when I'm here, it helps Mr. Coombs then to answer the current practices. They again give an answer that helps.
We've been only on that property for 2 years. The previous timing were on cattle up on the Harland area, some of the deer up here extensively, not the good stuff is going. There are deer up there, there are sheep, there are some sheep up there, and there are a lot of marine that's put up here, and some of the deer, and cattle.
I was wondering in terms of this paragraph 10, and this is where photo might come in handy, what it actually looked like if farming was no longer part of that. If farming was taken off the rural land and it was naturally converting back, what would we see in terms of that land?
If you're talking about the two catchments, the basic bit and other creek, for example, because they weren't being played, that would allow for more excitement to increase as across particularly the southern areas, which moisture is more favourable. But they are dry, the community quite robust. So I expect greater advancement in the absence of farming, particularly the insurance and heavy truck spraying of fire.
The shrub, how high would the shrub range grow to?
I think the shrub goes to about 900 metres above sea level.
Okay, well,
probably up to 3 metres in height, possibly 4 on really good sites. But I think it's like the more fish I'll start. Medicare in particular.
Is it likely that it would revert back to the forest?
Highly unlikely there. There's only, I count, two beech trees in the Bathurstburn. If you haven't got a really close seed source, beech trees have heavy seed, so they don't spread by winds. they sort of look pretty, pretty high, but I'm not sure.
Was the vegetation within those areas of natural conservation, could they potentially be get back to be established in the now, or to fit the criteria of any kind?
Over a long period of time, they could. But you, the reason why those areas are chosen is because they are extensive, but they do exist close canopy in a lot of areas and reasonable diversity. And that reversion, if you like, or succession, has taken place over a very long period. I'm talking many, many decades. Originally part of the woodland zone, I agree.
Thank you.
Thank you.